I wanted to offer a little bit here in the second half of this day with some intention of giving people a perspective, you might say, to continue this practice into the future, a way to hold it that might be helpful, both for folks who are new, but for any of us, because we're always starting afresh. And one of the most significant Dharma quotes in my life by Tibetan master Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche is, in paraphrase, worldly life is easy in the beginning and hard in the end, while spiritual life is hard in the beginning and easy in the end. And this captures an essential challenge of this path, of our path of cultivating mindfulness, which is that it can be somewhat difficult before the fruit of practice starts to manifest and we have a clear inner sense of direction that carries us forward. There's sort of a hump that a lot of people have to get over. And often people encounter the practice and have a whole lot of hope and optimism and joy about it, but then it kind of bogs down for a while. And I know with my experience of East Side Insight, I've seen people show up who were practicing and then they say, oh, I'm starting again, and then they vanish and then they come back and kind of like that. So I'd like to explore some of these difficulties and how they may manifest in your practice lives, as they do in all of ours, and some approaches to keep going in a way that'll bring benefit and fruition and joy along the way. So I want to decode that quote a little bit. Difficult in the beginning, easy in the end on the spiritual path, and easy in the beginning, hard at the end on the worldly path. Because there's a lot packed in there. So I'm often struck when I watch people around me by the kind of the grace and ease of youth and good looks. You know, if you look at our media entertainment industry, most of the people that it's pointed towards, they're young, they're healthy, they're attractive, while older and more weathered people kind of slip in occasionally as, you know, genre oddities or a career stretcher for some once young celebrity who's now old. So it's really focused on youth. And I don't frequent bars now or pre-COVID, but sometimes I've walked by and looked in windows and I've seen lots of these young, attractive people all energetically engaged with each other and dressed attractively and kind of aware of their visuals. And there's energy there and they're having a good time. But on a certain level, that's all dependent on their attractiveness and maybe an ability to finance being there. But it's all based on how it is at that moment. So that is easy in the beginning of worldly life. It's really easy. If you're in your early 20s and looking good, especially out here in tech community, there's a lot of people like that. But fast forward 60 years and suddenly 25-year-olds are 85 and suddenly life is hard. Now, many years ago, in the early 70s, I worked for a while in a nursing home as an aide. And I vividly remember several people there who had once identified with being young and attractive in their 20s, and now it was gone. And some of them told me with some bitterness that they just sort of weren't quite sure what had happened and why the person they were at 80 seemed so completely divorced from the person they remember being at 25. It wasn't working out so well. They were suffering. For them, worldly life was hard at the end. Now, on the spiritual path, on the Dharma path, we're asked to do just the opposite. I mean, it's not that we can't be young and attractive. I mean, I can't, but it's not that it's a prerequisite not to be. But we're turning away from attachment to conditionality and circumstance and instead toward letting go and not clinging. And maybe we have friends who are focused on filling their sense doors with delights, and that's cool. But we're turning towards something that may seem kind of sparse, you know, this moment-by-moment mindfulness with a vision of awakening or freedom somewhere in our hearts and minds. And I had the great honor back in 1988, I think it was, to meet Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the great leaders in the Thai forest tradition, at Swan Mok Monastery in Thailand. And he was often considered one of the great masters of the 20th century. And for some time, SIMS founder Rodney Smith took robes under his guidance, and also a prominent Western teacher, Guy Armstrong, also took robes with Buddhadasa. So I kind of just, you know, arrived at Swan Mok, and turns out most of the people were gone, but he was there. And so they said, oh, you can go ask a question. And I said, really? But anyway, they pointed, so I went. And there he was, sitting outside on a kind of beat-up kitchen chair in the dirt, surrounded by chickens pecking in the dirt and stacks of old magazines. He was very, very without presumption. And that's when I was just starting in the Dharma, kind of shifting out of another tradition, trying to understand some core ideas. So I asked him, is it true there's no self in Buddhism? And he looked at me for a few moments, and then I could feel this depth of practice just rolling off him in waves. It was like, oh my God. And he responded, no self. Kind of looks at me. All he says is no self. And then he just turned back to what he was doing. He was 82, that's old, when I met him. And he died 5 years later. But what I saw in him was this river of depth and equanimity and wisdom, a product of his practice on the very path that we're doing, sometimes in very arduous conditions in his case, and how it bore fruit, how it was easy in the end, because he did it. He was just beautiful and fulfilled there at the end of his life. It just like hit me in the heart somehow. I can't even say exactly why. It was this incredibly short little exchange, and it just like pivoted my mind. And I've seen with other great Asian Dharma masters and Western great masters that they manifest, they kind of emulate this easy in the end, where the fruit can bring us, where the fruit of the practice can bring us in this ease and grace that all comes out of the inside. So that's part of our possibility on the path to live in that, regardless of conditions, regardless of age. But getting to easy at the end doesn't come without effort. And the life stories of the great masters are filled with obstacles they've surmounted and challenges they met on the path, as is with basically everyone I know in the Sangha, on this spiritual community. Everybody goes through stuff and struggles with stuff, because that's the very nature of, yeah. Tim's got his hand up. Can't hear you though, Tim.
Yes, sorry to interrupt, Steve. It seems like your mic might be scratching against your shirt or something.
Thank you. Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, I appreciate that. Yep, I can hold it up here. Thank you. Because that's the very nature of it. Nature of the path is untangling what sticks us. Achan Cha, another great Thai forest master, for instance, for years as a monk, he struggled with the tug of sexuality, and he also faced fear of tigers. And in one case, an actual heavily breathing tiger just a few feet away outside of the mosquito net of his umbrella for hours, threatening to devour him. So he worked through all kinds of difficult in the beginning stuff. So maybe we have, you know, our own tigers to face are hard in the beginning. So I'd like to offer a few difficulties we might encounter and a few ways to navigate them. And as you might expect, the Buddha had a list about one way of looking at this, the five hindrances. And I know Tim and I both talked about that in our introductions. So I won't go into detail, but these are looking at it from this framework. These are conditions people encounter along the way, you know, very relevant here in 2022, maybe helpful to you to understand in the context of what I'm sharing. In short, the five are desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And just to sort them in your minds, you might notice there's two sets of opposing pairs. So desire and aversion, restlessness and sloth and torpor, and then the fifth, doubt. So we're not going to go into, you know, details about those, but a big breakthrough in my practice, the thing I want to offer here is that these are objects of mindfulness. And that just shifted things profoundly for me when I realized that the Buddha had placed the five hindrances in what's called the fourth foundation of mindfulness, right where he basically said, here's a vast panorama of aspects of life to be mindful of. And among those is the five hindrances. So once I got around that, got my heart around that, I started relating to them very differently. Because it's easy to look at them as like this negative challenge to be surmounted, just a problem I wish would go away, something to avoid. But when we start to think about them as something to be mindful of, just like a pain in the knee, just like buzzing thoughts, then we can have a much more relaxed and even interested attitude toward them. It's not a matter of opposition. It's a matter of bringing insight. And that makes the hard in the beginning a lot easier to just bring mindfulness to the obstacles that seem to us really difficult or even frustrating or might even derail us. Just to go, oh yeah, you again. And just show up with interest and bring that into mindfulness and start to deconstruct it. You know, all of these things, they kind of come at us like a big sticky something, you know, aversion, this big sticky something. But to start to feel, where do we feel it? Maybe we feel that in our bodies. Often we feel a lot of stuff in our bodies that is an obstacle, and just bring it into our mindfulness practice. So for me, I'm most prone to restlessness, and sometimes it's agitation, sometimes it's fast-moving planning mind, sometimes it's discomfort in the body. But I've just learned, even the fact that I can sort of name that stuff, I can really see the discomfort in the body when I'm restless. You know, just learn to do is to bring that into the path, bring my mindfulness to it, and just not have it be a problem. Almost kind of celebrate it. Oh, yeah, this part of the unpeeling is to face this thing which is characteristic of my own obscurations. To just walk up to it. And to be able, especially with the body stuff, you know, I sort of throw that out because I've heard, you know, in the discussions today, in the breakout rooms, and certainly in the past, a lot of obstacles, difficult in the beginning things that people present, like strong emotions, there's a big body component. So that's why we can always come back to the breath, always come back to mindfulness of body. And that can bring us like a sense of humor, you know, a sense of humor, a sense of lightness, because we need that. We need that to keep difficult in the beginning from taking us out or derailing us. And it's hard, you know, 2022, we're surrounded by distractions and we're surrounded by this uber materialistic culture where technology is so advanced, it almost seems like magic. So, you know, to be able to find the inner magic of awakening can be a little elusive. Back 2,600 years ago, there wasn't all this, you know, the biggest technology was probably a wheel or a spear. So it wasn't so pulling us away from possibility. But now you have to really, we're going uphill, but that's okay because it works. And the second factor related to difficult in the beginning is how far away easy in the end can seem. It's just hard to keep our hearts, hard to keep our compass on what is possible on this journey ahead when we're so diverted. And certainly people around us, a lot of them, probably think we're wasting our time, get gentle pushback in different ways, all kinds of things. But the amazing thing is this freedom isn't that far away. You know, it's right here moment by moment. And we can start to see little glimmers of opening that make a big difference. And that can help us move ahead. And to be sure, even in the Buddha's time, even in the presence of the Buddha himself, many didn't see their own potential in their exchanges with him. It's hard to believe, but that is true. Several times in the discourses, there's one particular one, he delivers this incredibly deep and eloquent discourse to Pasenadi, one of the kings of the time, the kind of discourse that would immediately awaken any of the monastics or many of the monastics at the time. But the power of it basically missed the king entirely. At the end of this incredible, it's in the suttas, at the end of this incredible discourse, the king says, Lord, permit me to depart now. I am busy and have much to do. And the Buddha is always very supportive, and he says, do now, your majesty, as you see fit. But I love it. I am busy and have much to do. Have you ever said that to yourself? Or you hear that from each other? Oh, yeah, I got to do this stuff. I can't really sit this morning, or can't really sit tonight, or don't have time to be mindful, don't have time to kind of be present. So that's what the king said, right to the Buddha's face. I am busy and have much to do. So you can kind of, in a weird kind of way, feel like a commonality there. Oh, yeah, if the king didn't get it, we can be excused for not getting it, but then let's get it. You know, let's keep refreshing our sense of things. So the point is, you know, don't berate yourself if sometimes you get off the rails, don't get it, forget. That doesn't mean something's wrong with you. And it doesn't mean you can't be transformed either. It just means it's hard. It can be hard to get going. Sometimes it just opens up. You know, it's a funny thing with the practice, like you go through, I know, just speaking for myself, I'll go through dry periods, and I learn, it's like, okay, dry period, and, you know, nothing's happening, but I'll just hang in there, and then suddenly, woof, something opens up, and when it does, I can see that there were foundations in the dry period that were very integral to what I'm seeing now. The mere attunement or effort to pay attention during the dry period was, in fact, the doorway I had to walk through. So I think that's the case with everybody. So, you know, we have to keep continuing. One of my Tibetan teachers, Jagat Tukul Rinpoche, he always said, don't give up. I mean, he said that all the time. He taught Westerners a lot. And he always said, don't give up. And in a weird kind of way, that's like the only thing I remember that he taught. This incredibly deep Tibetan master. But don't give up is such a precious thing to remember and to do. So on the path, you know, one thing we need to do, and part of why teachings are actually really worthwhile, you know, you might think, oh, this is so simple, why don't I just, you know, sit down and practice? But teachings are worthwhile, whether by, you know, teachers like Tim, or from reading the words of the Buddha, or from what you hear, because they keep realigning us and keep clarifying our direction. And for those of you who read the suttas, you may experience that you come around again and read something you read 2 years ago, and it's like, oh my God, you suddenly see a whole other layer of it you didn't see before. So A, it kept you going, and B, that sort of a sense that you're getting clearer, you're growing, that you can see more than you did before. So keep working on that. You know, we need to keep regenerating confidence in our potential of awakening, and then keep regenerating our sense of how to do it, the steps to take, and they reinforce each other and become clear. It self emerges over time. It starts to be, oh yeah, I know. I've been, Joseph Goldstein is a great, great Western teacher, and he's incredibly articulate, the way he just says things in this unbelievably simple way. But you get the sense it's like, it's so clear to him, and he's like just trying to explain it. You know, it's just like, it's not like he's stretching. He's just like, oh, okay, I know I can get this through to you guys. Just trying to explain it. So we all develop in that direction. Sharon Salzberg, another wonderful Western teacher, in her book Faith, which is a great book, makes it clear how important is our confidence in our potential. So she's not talking about blind faith, which was believing in stuff you cannot prove, but rather confidence in how we can unfold, how the direction of this path self-reveals as we progress, and then pulls us forward. You know, there comes sort of a tipping point in the practice where things start getting clearer and clearer, and you have no choice but to go ahead. In Tibetan tradition, they say the path is like a snake in the tube. A snake in the tube, and once you're in the tube, a snake can't go back. Has to go forward. So at a certain point, it becomes really clear there's no potential but to continue growing. The distractions of the world just seem like dust. What's the point? Got to go ahead, because that's where possibility lies. Sharon writes, when we look at the Buddha or a great teacher, we can see that our own potential for happiness, for vibrant wisdom and sustained compassion, a potential that all beings share. So that's confidence. And there's a marvelous list. What I love about her stuff is that she talks about, in a very human way, her contacts with awakened beings. And on the one hand, the kind of the vigor of her practice, but one of the charms is she also chronicles her mishaps and mistakes and her embarrassments, and she just kind of lays it all out. It's like, oh yeah, this way I flopped down, I fell down, and then I stood up again. And so that's really helpful for us to just, oh yeah, okay, we're in this together, and we'll stand up again. So she doesn't give up. And slowly in her splendid life, you can really see it's easy in the end. Kitty, I love you, but you got to go down. So, you know, for all of you, as you step into this next stage, maybe there's two things I might suggest. One is just find ways to continue your mindfulness practice in any ways that work for you. The more energy you bring to it, the more it'll be effective, and the more the way ahead will be self-evident. You know, mindfulness on the cushion, mindfulness while cleaning the dishes, it all works. You may know, I can't think of her name, but that's embarrassing. But anyway, Stephen Armstrong's partner, she, you can tell me, Tim.
Kamala.
Thank you. Yes, Kamala Masters. Thank you. She did much of her practice as a single mom with three kids, which meant she did it walking down the hall to put her kids to bed. She did it washing the dishes because she's a single mom with three kids. And, you know, she didn't give up. So we can do much the same. And a second thought is to find ways to contact that which turns you ahead, which turns you into possibility, into easy in the end. This may can mean a lot of things. It can mean beings more awakened than yourself right now. And that's great. You know, this could be people in your Sangha. This could be online. That's one of the sort of strange upsides about 2022 and even about the pandemic is the world of online Dharma has opened up so much. And then what's going on with Sims with this lovely year-long presentation on the ox herding photos, you know, just whatever your heart turns toward that's going to help you see through the morass of 21st century distraction. So don't give up. Just go past the immediate hills of difficulty in the beginning, so it'll be easy in the end. Why don't we just sit for a minute, and we can continue.